Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Lance Lerner. This time I'm going to be talking with Professor Gauthier Gunel about her new book, Spaceship in the Desert, Energy, Climate Change, and Urban Design in Abu Dhabi, out this year, 2019, by Duke University Press. Spaceship in the Desert explores the United Arab Emirates' planned Masdar City, an experimental attempt at designing an emissions-free society. The first parts of Masdar City opened beside the Abu Dhabi airport in 2010 as an oil wealth-funded initiative to establish the UAE as a leader in the renewable energy sector and to begin to prepare the Emirates for a low or post-oil economy. Quickly, however, the master plan was abandoned as unworkable. But Masdar City also was not a failure. Rather, Gunel explores the interconnected social, technical, and political ramifications and adaptations involved in this attempt to design a potential fossil fuel-free future. She shrewdly criticizes the limitations of climate change strategies intended to protect the political economic status quo, yet also through deep ethnographic fieldwork with participants, Gunel demonstrates the valuable role of anthropological insight in social and technological adaptations to climate change. I'm very pleased to now be sharing with you my interview with Professor Gauthier Gunel. So, Gauthier, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for your invitation. It's a pleasure.
Yes, it's wonderful to have you here. Can you just explain a little bit what Masdar City looks like in its genesis for listeners who don't know?
So Masdar City was initially brought together as and designed and promoted as an eco-city project, a smart city and eco-city that would rely only on renewable energies and clean technologies. It was Abu Dhabi's response. Abu Dhabi is one of the major oil producers in the world, and there's amongst oil producers a general anxiety about sort of what's going to happen when the oil runs out or when oil becomes less valuable. So in responding to that threat or that anxiety, the Emirate of Abu Dhabi decided to sort of invest in renewable energies, clean technologies, and Masdar City would be the iconic sort of representation of that investment. It was designed a master plan by Foster and Partners, which is a architecture office that grew out of London and operates internationally now. And so Masdar City would not only be a sort of like a showcase, demonstrating the potential of the renewable energy and clean technology projects happening in Abu Dhabi, but it would also be a hub for renewable energy clean technology companies. So it would be like a special economic zone where many renewable energy clean technology companies could come and open their offices there, etc. It became very popular. It was in the news a lot and starting in 2006 all the way up to 2011. And it was kind of featured as a sort of a utopian project, a science fiction project, an answer to sort of how people are going to live at the time of energy scarcity and climate change. In 2011, when the master plan got canceled, that hype sort of died down, and the media started covering it as a sort of the first ghost eco-city or the first ghost smart city. And And so my narrative tries to sort of position it as something that's really neither of those things, neither really the utopian project that's going to change the world, nor a sort of a ghost city that's an utter failure.
Can you describe a little bit the first time you got there and what it looked like and what it feels like to be in this space?
So the project was designed for 50,000 people and 40,000 commuters. And so it's described as a full city project in its commentaries, in its early commentaries. But when I first showed up there, of course, it was a construction site, and there was the first buildings that were put together were the buildings of Masdar Institute. Now, I mean, it's not a branch campus, but it's a research institute that was sort of put together by MIT's Technology and Development Program. And so when I first visited, it's the site that's set by the Abu Dhabi airport. It's by a golf course. It's by the Formula One track. So it's this kind of this zone that's dedicated to renewable energies and clean technologies, but it's actually surrounded by all these heavy emitters. And it's that initial experience of the site always makes people wonder what the site really is trying to achieve, and makes people think that this is actually a paradox, right? But in a way, after talking to some people there and spending some time there, I was able to see that these are all different kinds of economic diversification strategies that the Emirate of Abu Dhabi is attempting. And so let's see which one's going to work out. Maybe it's going to be the Formula One tracks that help Abu Dhabi move to a future with less oil, or a post-oil future. Maybe it's going to be the golf courses. Maybe it's going to be the airport, and all these become part of sort of the 2030 economic vision. And so I spent most of my research there happened in 2010 and 2011, and in those years, the Masdar Institute campus had been finished and had started functioning. And the students who did master's and PhD degrees at Masdar Institute were the only inhabitants of Masdar City. And faculty members commuted there. And there's also a sort of the makeshift office of the other Masdar bodies. And so there were people commuting to the site to come and work in their offices, but they weren't really fully living there. But the presence of all those people allowed me to sort of understand how the people who are participating in the construction of an eco-city actually reflect on what that eco-city means, both for the sort of their immediate environment, so for the Emirate of Abu Dhabi, for the region, so for the Gulf, or also globally. So there are multiple scales at which the project operates.
Yeah. So could you describe then a little bit as we'll get deeper and deeper into the experience of these cosmopolitan students and researchers who are building this place. But can you first describe a little bit about what you expected this research to be about when you got there, and how your experience there really changed your questions and your interpretations?
Yeah, thank you for that. That's actually a really important question, because when I first started thinking about doing research on Masdar City, I started contacting various people who were involved in the project. Mostly these people were affiliated with MIT and were the sort of the easiest people for me to access and meet up with and talk to. And one of the people I met asked me, so do you intend this project to be the classic science and technology studies book, Bruno Latour's Aramis, or The Love of Technology. And in that book, Latour is looking at the sort of collapse of a person rapid and transit technology project sort of in Paris. And it's in a way a story of what Latour calls an autopsy of failure. So why do projects fail, and how do projects fail? And he asks explicitly, so who killed Aramis? And the book is sort of put together as a sort of almost like a detective novel where, two people, two sociologists of science and technology get together to understand who killed Aramis. And And initially, that was the approach that I had towards this project as well. So how does, why does the project not work according to the sort of the ways in which it's imagined? But once I started talking to people and started visiting the site and started spending more time in Abu Dhabi, I realized that that approach was probably quite limiting because the binary of success and failure was going to be less helpful for me than actually asking people how they understand the future of the project and how they feel potential about this project. So why do people invest their time and energy into this project, and what's the kind of, what are the different kinds of futures that they see emerging from the project? So conceptually, that was the big shift that I experienced. And that was, that's actually, I think, one of the major contributions of the book, is that it's looking at this sort of non-teleological temporality of sort of thinking about the multiple ways in which we imagine imagine time and imagine the future.
Yeah, and temporality is such an important theme when it comes to climate change and how we think about it, whether it's that sense of impending urgency that is everywhere in the news, or whether it's about this kind of always imagining a slightly different future just beyond the horizon. And it seems in this work, you're really dealing with how these actors are thinking about potential and how potential gets created and how we imagine it. How do you think about this idea of potential, and how do you unpack what goes into it?
I mean, I most of what I took from that idea was given to me by my interlocutors, and I really work with their definitions of how they understand potential. And one of the core sort of parts of that was this deep belief in sort of how new technologies, new business models, and new design solutions are going to help us change the world. So there's a very sort of investment in the in progress, investment in sort of despite climate change and energy scarcity problems, through sort of technical adjustments, we're going to actually be able to preserve the status quo, at least for a small percentage of the human population. So that's the kind of potential that I think people saw as existing in this project. In the book, I call it a status quo utopia, because it's not a utopia that's really intending to reach a non-place or a non-synchronous temporality. It's actually something that, it's an attempt at preserving existing social, political, and economic conditions for a select group of human beings. That's the aspiration that many of my interlocutors shared. And it's not that people did not question these aspirations, but they thought that this was inevitable. This is the best case scenario. This is the best thing they can do, because everything else is going to be asking too much and asking and be too ambitious. Really, it would be overreaching. Despite the sort of the utopian, again, ambitions of the project, there's a sort of something that's deeply conservative about the imagination of the project and the design of the project.
Yeah, and can you describe a little bit then what was expected? You know, is there first envisioning this project back in 2006, and as Foster and Partners begins to design it, what was the idea about how this place, on the one hand, it's this kind of closed utopian community that's supposed to be sustainable and so forth, but it's also supposed to be modeling practices that are to get exported. Is that right?
Yes, definitely.
And how did they actively try to do that, or what role did that end up playing in the Institute?
Both of those things were important, because it was seen as a sort of a hub, an isolated or insulated hub. But in that hub, there would be sort of new ideas emerging in that hub, and new ideas being experimented with. It's a test bed, and in the test bed, you can see how certain things work or don't work. And then based on their sort of functionality within this test bed, they can be exported, etc. So all these ideas were constantly being circulated. And And so, which made the presence of a research institute, Masdar Institute, very significant, because some of the work that was going to come out of there, some of the idea was that the Masdar Institute would be like a Stanford or an MIT, which would lead to the creation of many startups in Abu Dhabi, and those startups would generate a sort of a new economic powerhouse in Abu Dhabi. That would be an alternative to the existing oil economy. And given that there's a lot of, as you know, Abu Dhabi is very deeply embedded in networks of energy, it would be easy for those networks to be sort of retooled and reconfigured as non-oil but non-fossil fuel networks that would still, so that was a big part of the project. And there was also, in addition to sort of the Masdar Institute project, there are other sort of a smaller, I mean, the other components of the project. That was Masdar Capital, which invested in renewable energy, clean technology companies around the world. Masdar Power, which actually built solar power stations and wind power stations. Masdar Carbon, which was a climate change policy unit. So all of these units also supplemented the work that was going on at the Institute in making sure that the research that's being put together inside Masdar City could be exported to other parts of the world and could be turned into capital for Abu Dhabi. And I think some of that work still continues. Despite the master plan's cancellation in 2011, the Masdar City still retains its sort of character as the renewable energy clean technology center within the Arabian Peninsula. And so the multiple companies have come in and built their buildings there. So for instance, Siemens has a R&D center there, etc. So all of these activities go on, but what's changed is that it's no longer an eco-city or a smart city in the way that it was imagined, but now it's become what its promoters call a city of possibilities. And it's a lot closer in its current conception to the oil company towns of sort of 20th century or to special economic zones that we know of from around the world, which sort of specialize in certain kinds of products and offer tax benefits for the people who build or export or import those products. And it's not, in a way, this transformation is not that surprising because there are other versions of these kinds of zones in the UAE. So, for instance, one of the examples that my interlocutors often use was the Media City in Dubai, which they saw as being quite successful because all the media companies function there together as a hub. So those were some of the ambitions, and I think those ambitions are constantly changing. But the period that I looked at, which is the 2010 to 2011 period, was critical because it saw the cancellation of the master plan and because it saw the cancellation of some of the more experimental projects that were happening on site, and that was a period when the sort of the idea of the city of possibilities started to emerge and started to replace the idea of the eco-city or the smart city.
Yeah, and for the people who are residing in Masdar and, you know, these international students and researchers and so forth, how do they interpret the ending of the master plan?
I mean, the people who were inhabiting the city were there for short periods of time. They knew that they weren't going to necessarily live there all their lives. And they saw themselves as test subjects within the construction of this project. And they thought that, in a way, their reactions were being somewhat recorded, but they didn't fully understand if their reactions were really transforming the decision-making on site or having any impact on decision-making. But they knew that they were being watched for their water consumption, for their electricity consumption. They knew that if they wrote a commentary on the city, the commentary would be picked up quite quickly by the media, by researchers from around the world, because there was a lot of interest in the project at the time. So they didn't necessarily see themselves as fully sort of as, say, citizens of Masdar City in that way, but they saw themselves more as experimental subjects that were there for a short period of time, and that they knew that they were going to leave once they graduated. So they knew that they weren't actually going to, you know, rent apartments on Masdar City and continue living there. They want to sort of benefit from some of the startup opportunities that were happening, but some of them, I imagine, will be able to do that even going forward in the future. But many others actually took on jobs. I mean, they either pursued PhD degrees abroad in other countries, or they joined companies in the UAE or elsewhere. There were most of the people who were going to school at Masdar Institute or pursuing degrees there had the sort of the international sort of capacity to be competitive on other job markets outside the UAE as well. So they benefit. I mean, they took advantage of that.
Yeah. Can we talk then about some of the technologies that are really being developed, these technical adjustments at Masdar? And you write about a number of them in your book, including this energy currency and the rapid transit, the personal rapid transit system. Maybe the place it starts is the transit system. And can you describe what this was and what happened with it?
Yeah, I think the transit system is actually a very good example of sort of some of the of the projects that were happening there, and I think it's also conceptually been really important for me in thinking about what the project is trying to do. What it is a person rapid transit is a technology that emerged in the 70s, and it was experimented with in different parts of the world, in Japan and in Europe, partially in the US as well. It's a set of, I mean, person rapid transit constitutes of individual pods that are not on a track, that are not on a railway track, that can sort of, you get on a pod and you say, I want to go to the station X, and the pod takes you to that station without necessarily stopping at other stations on the way. So it was very popular because it's a way of bringing together public transport. So you don't have to park your car. You don't have to necessarily buy a car in the first place. But at the same time, it gives you the flexibility to sort of directly go to your destination without sharing the pod with too many people. So in the case of the Masdar project, for instance, the pods could have up to 6 people in them. But mostly, ideally, they would say if there are 4 people, then you should be ready to go. So this is because it's a combination of sort of it combines the advantages of public transport and private cars. It was popular all around the world in the 70s and 80s. But then the infrastructure required for putting it together and proved very financially demanding, and many of those projects were cancelled, although they were celebrated in their initial conception. So, what makes them also quite, you know, look futuristic, and what makes them sort of significant for our visions of the future is the fact that they're driverless, right? So you get on a pod and there is no driver. You just click on a sort of a screen and you say, and actually, in the case of the Masdar pods, there's a sort of an automated voice that actually greets you and says, okay, I'm going to now take you to your station. And in a way, aesthetically speaking, it's a lot of sort of these ideals of sort of the 1960s future coming together, and which is what made the Masdar pods attractive for many people. Many people came to Masdar City to experience the pods, to see the pods in action, and to almost as visitors to an amusement park. Many of my interlocutors said that they were, you know, the pods were actually a major attraction. And in the case of Masdar City, what happened was that, you know, the people said that one of the main reasons Foster and Partners won the master plan was because they came up with pods as a transportation solution for the city. The pods would eliminate the driver, so there would be no need for workers to enter the city, and at the same time the pods would be in what they called sort of the undercroft, a basement level, which would be sort of hidden from view. So the city would actually be, would have no transportation at sort of the on the, you know, the pedestrian platform. All the transportation would be hidden, almost like a subway network. And all of those things made a PRT very desirable. But once the construction began and once the financial crisis hit, the developers and the designers realized that it was going to be very expensive to actually lift the whole city off the ground and build a basement in which the PRT can function. So there were a lot of discussions about whether the PRT should be canceled. Is it going to be kept? What's going to happen to it? And many people said, you know, PRT is so important for the city. It's actually why people want to read about Masdar, why people want to see Masdar. But at the end, at the end of 2010 and early 2011, the decision was made to cancel the PRT project. So at the end, what's still there now and what was there when I was doing my research there was there are two stops, one in the parking lot outside Masdar Institute and one inside Masdar Institute. So you could drive to Masdar City, park your car, and get on one of these pods, and the ride would take about 2 minutes, and then you would arrive at Masdar Institute, and you would go up the staircase into the sort of the Masdar Institute labs and classroom spaces. So at the end, it is just a two-minute ride. And many people have also criticized it for saying, you know, I could have actually walked this distance. Why did I need the PRT? I could have ridden a bicycle. But the presence of the PRT allowed many people to come together and to sort of really discuss what they expect the future to be like. What do they envision for a post climate change, post energy scarcity world, and what kinds of transportation solutions that are going to service that world?
Yeah, you know, so I mean, this is one of those examples where it's difficult, and you do a great job in this book, and we probably won't cover all of it right now, but where it's difficult to think about success and failure and where you draw that line. And I'm thinking about those of us in the humanities. You know, we love to point at techno-utopian visions of geoengineers and so forth and say, you know, this is all a failure. We love to point out those failures. But in your book, you don't do that. And instead, you look at this with a much more nuanced and detailed eye. Why do you think that's important?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's important to be able to see the projects from the perspectives of the people who are working on them. The people who are working on them don't necessarily see the projects as failures and don't necessarily want to see them as failures. They've invested in, say, in the case of the PRT, many people have invested decades of their lives working on these projects. And I wanted to understand how they envision these projects and how they envision the impact that these projects might have on resolving energy and climate change related problems. I mean, I think there's a lot of people have written about how Masdar City is a sort of a greenwashing project. And I think that's partially right. I mean, it definitely has that. It does that for the Emirate of Abu Dhabi, but not all the, I mean, there are many people who participate in the construction of a project like this. And I wanted to understand how they react to the so-called utopian ambitions of the project and take their perspectives as valuable contributions on a sort of a larger debate on how we envision life beyond climate change and energy at the time of climate change. So, I understand the sort of geoengineering conversations are very prominent in work on climate change, and I understand sort of, and I agree with a lot of the hesitation regarding the geoengineering projects. And regarding the sort of kinds of failures and successes, but I also wanted to sort of show how, in this project, and in sort of in ideas, larger ideas of smartness as well, the success and failure always have to be postponed, and there's has to always be space for sort of thinking about these projects as always being in beta mode, right? Always adjustable, always ready for reconfiguration for. Model 2. So, and And that's another way in which that's also one, I mean, in discussions of smartness as well, people pay attention to these kinds of delays or these kinds of sort of the logic of the test bed. And I think that's why it was also specifically important to look at how success and ideas of success and failure get avoided in a project that defines itself as being a smart city.
Yeah. So do you see your project that is in some way, this book, do you see it as in some way contributing to the experiment of Mastar?
I hope so, in a way. I mean, I don't know if it's a... I mean, I think it's not necessarily contributing to the experiment of Mastar in the way that the people, decision makers at Mastar would want it to contribute to, I imagine. I mean, I'm not sure if they... But it definitely tracks the kind of processes of innovation that were happening there. And it tracks the ways in which the people who were participating in the project were seeing the project, and which is not necessarily something that happens in institutions of this size, where people, or at least wasn't the case at Mastar, where people weren't necessarily communicating with one another and sharing their thoughts on different projects with one another at the sort of a, it's just that everyone's trying to get by and finish their work for the day, right? So I think by interviewing many of the actors there and by spending time with them and doing participant observation on the site, I was able to lead them to ask questions that they wouldn't have normally asked themselves. And so I think there's both my research experience and then I think the book as well is going to have an impact on sort of how renewable energy and technology professionals see their own projects, even if it doesn't necessarily impact the construction of Mastar City per se.
So I'm wondering a little bit that I, at one point in the book, you mentioned that some figures within the project at one point thought about bringing in a team of anthropologists to examine the development of it. And this eventually gets canceled or unfunded. But I'm wondering then a little bit about what you think is the importance of your discipline in ethnography in this moment of global warming and the development of these different kinds of technologies. And I'm thinking a lot about how many of the most prominent writers about global warming or the Anthropocene, as we usually call it, really address the relationship between humans and what we used to call nature and how this needs to be rethought. And so I'm wondering, and that's where a lot of scholarly attention has gone, but I'm wondering if you see a more important role for scholars to be playing a more integrated relationship with the forms of technology, with the social institutions that are trying to find solutions and ways to work through global warming.
I wouldn't say one of them is more important than the other is less important, but I do think that there's a sort of a need to engage with the kind of the cultures of expertise formed around climate change issues and energy issues, more widely speaking. I think that was one of my attempts was to sort of map and document and analyze this culture of expertise around renewable energy and clean technology projects and to show with what priorities those experts work and what do they really want to achieve in their work. And I think one of the things I found in the book is that beyond sort of thinking about climate change mitigation and adaptation projects, one of the things that many of the people I worked with want to achieve is the preservation of capitalism. And their major quest is actually to sort of see how can we preserve capitalism in the way that it's functioning today, while at the same time trying to find technical solutions to energy and climate change problems. And this becomes, I mean, many of the people I work with don't ever question that. They take that at face value as the sort of the, almost as the background on which they work. But I think as the climate change conversation develops and we're seeing that that's not necessarily an assumption that we can continue to make and that we need to rethink that assumption and challenge that assumption if we really want to stop, sort of mitigate climate change. And I think if by doing work amongst energy experts or amongst clean technology experts, you're able to see those fundamental assumptions, and you're able to only want, when you actually see those fundamental assumptions, can you start challenging them and interrogating them in meaningful ways.
Yeah, so that's a great reason for some very integrated ethnographic work with
this. Exactly, and I mean, and also other people have done this kind of work before. I mean, for instance, in the 1970s, Laura Nader, who was one of the sort of the first people who did work amongst energy experts. I mean, she did this kind of work to sort of see what are the kinds of assumptions that energy experts make in their daily conversations. What are the things that they never question, and how can we actually reveal those things so that we begin to ask questions about them? So,
thank you for that. And there's much more in this book, and it's a very rich piece of scholarship, and you cover so much, including carbon capture and storage, and the idea of an energy currency, and the architecture of the place, the PR, the energy system, and so forth. And I want to leave much of that for the readers to find themselves. But is there some part of this book that we haven't covered that you want to make sure that is present here on this interview?
I think it might be important to sort of talk about the title of the book a little bit, because the title is also kind of a homegrown title, in that it actually came from one of my interlocutors. It's an ethnographic title, but at the same time, it's a title that I think has conceptual value in describing and analyzing the project. And the title came from a student who was finishing a master's degree at Masdar Institute. And she was one of the first people who moved into the Masdar Institute campus. And when she got there, she wrote on her blog an entry, which she called "A Spaceship in the Middle of the Desert." And many people became attracted to it, and many people called her up. And she was very surprised at the kind of attention that she received. And once that sort of that idea of the spaceship in the desert became sort of available, many people from many of the executives from Masdar also took it up and started using it in their descriptions of the city or in communicating their understandings of the city. And I call the book "Spaceship in the Desert" because one of the things I try to do in the book is to ask why this description became so important and so definitive in a way. I mean, so useful for the people who are making the project happen. And I saw how the idea of the spaceship is this sort of technologically enhanced space, but it's also insulated. It's also mobile in that it can explore new frontiers. It can carry us forward, or carry its own residents, carry its inhabitants forward into a future that's not yet available to us. And it's also operating in the desert. And so the desert has always been seen as this sort of, by sort of French and British colonialists, especially, this like diseased space that's going to need fixing. Or it's also been seen as, I mean, if you look at science fiction movies, most of the, the planets that the protagonists of those movies travel to, have deserts on them. So if you think about movies like Star Wars, etc., they take place in deserts. So the desert is also embodies this sort of exotic set of exotic meanings for its not for its dwellers necessarily, but for the people inhabiting it, for the people coming to inhabit it from the outsiders. So I think it's important to sort of all think about all of those things and understanding how we imagine the future of urban design, right? Or is it going to be, are our ecocities or the spaces that we're going to inhabit in a sort of post-oil future going to be these spaces that are cut off from the world at large, are insulated like spaceships, but technologically enhanced, and also I mean, if you can think about processes of selection for entering a spaceship or becoming an astronaut, you can also think about sort of what that means for an urban project. So I think maybe I'll just leave it, the listeners at that. And yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great place to end. Gochi, what are you going to be working on next?
So I want to continue working on energy and environment related issues. And I'm actually now looking at temporary energy technologies. One of the things I'm interested in is sort of how infrastructure becomes provisional and what are the kinds of things that provisional, the kinds of benefits provisional infrastructures can provide. So I'm looking at very sort of low-tech projects. One of the things I'm now writing about is floating power plants, old ships that become retrofitted to function as power plants. These power plants use heavy fuel oil or natural gas. And one of the floating power plants I'm looking at is in Ghana. It's built by a Turkish company, and it produces 23% of Ghana's electricity. And I'm trying to sort of see, as we're looking at sort of the energy transitions, we've always focused on sort of the transition to renewable energies and clean technologies. And the spaceship in the desert also does mm-hmm. that work. But I'm trying to see if and how the transition to, you know, fossil fuels happens in places that we haven't necessarily studied. So, for instance, in Ghana, hydroelectric power was very significant, but climate change has has impacted the water levels in hydroelectric power stations. And so it's become necessary to use these technologies that are, considered dirty technologies, but at the same time, technologies that don't require any upfront capital requirements and that don't necessarily, that are easy to lease. You don't need to buy them. You don't need to build them. So I'm following up with some of the questions from the book, but instead of looking at how oil-rich countries plan for a future beyond oil, I'm looking at places that suffer from energy scarcity in the present and that try to find solutions quick and urgent solutions to energy problems in the present. So the temporality of the project is a little bit different, and the kinds of technologies I'm looking at are a little bit different, but I'm still interested in exploring energy and environment-related questions.
Well, I hope I get the opportunity to interview about that book when that comes out.
Thank you so much. I hope so too.
Okay, thank you so much for your time.
Have a great day. Bye.